Good afternoon, and welcome to the 2012 Diane Sanger Memorial Lecture, broadcast live from the Georgetown University Law Center, and worldwide online at www.sechistorical.org. I'm Richard Nesson, president of the SEC Historical Society, which is presenting today's program. The Historical Society, which is a nonprofit organization entirely independent of the SEC, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through its virtual museum and archive located at www.sechistorical.org. The virtual museum and archive, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year, provides visitors access at all times to primary sources that are part of the history of the U.S. financial regulatory system, including papers, oral histories, photos, and film, radio, and television media. And through its programs, the museum seeks to contribute to that history. Our hope is that today's program, examining the survival of investor protection as a goal, will help shape the ongoing debate about the proper role of financial regulation. By doing so, today's discussion will recognize and further the values that Diane Sanger sought to implement throughout her too brief life. We would like to thank Georgetown University Law Center for joining with us to present today's programs. Support for the growth of the Virtual Museum and Archive comes entirely from gifts and grants from individuals and institutions. The Society is grateful for the generous gift from the family of Diane Sanger in order to make today's lecture possible. I am delighted to welcome Bryna Sanger, Senior Vice President and Deputy Provost of the New School and a sister of Diane's, to speak on behalf of the family.
Hi, I'm Bryna Sanger, Diane's sister, and on behalf of my family, it gives us really great pleasure to collaborate with the SEC Historical Society, especially with Carla Rosati and Richard Nesson, who have been such good partners in furthering this annual lecture to honor my sister and in some way to continue her work. We're also grateful to Georgetown Law School and to Dean Treanor, who has been gracious to host us today and to lend their distinguished reputation to this event. This annual lecture is a particularly meaningful way to recognize the importance of Diane's legacy and of her deeply held commitments. And today is especially significant because of the close connection Diane had working with Professor Goldschmidt when he was general counsel, and with Commissioner Walter, both of whom figured centrally in her life and her work at the commission. They were her mentors. We're grateful to both of them for helping us to honor her life and her career in this way. Thank you.
Thank you, Bryna. I'm pleased now to welcome William Treanor, Professor of Law and Executive Vice President and Dean, to speak on behalf of the Georgetown Law Center.
Thanks very much, Mr. Nesson, and it's my privilege to be able to welcome you here on behalf of the Law Center. Georgetown has a close connection with the SEC Historical Society since the founding of its virtual museum and archive on the history of financial regulation a decade ago. Professor Langvoort, a member of the Society's Board of Advisors, hosted a planning meeting of academics here in the museum's early years that launched the Society's Museum Committee. Professor Bob Thompson was also for many years a member of that committee, and Don served as a moderator and presenter in some of the museum's past programs and will be part of the upcoming Ponzi Scheme Puzzles broadcast next month. That's right. That's right. I'll be better in kind of breaking the title. And Georgetown, of course, has had a close relationship with the SEC and other federal government agencies for millennia. We're proud that many of our graduates take on public services as Diane Sanger did during her really extraordinary career. Our reputation as an academic leader located in the heart of the nation's capital provides our students with the unique intellectual and geographic convergence of laws and ideas and And I'm grateful to have the opportunity to welcome you here today. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your remarks, Dean. Diane Sanger is a wonderful example of the dedicated individuals, past, present, and future, who contribute to the creation and administration of fair and effective regulation. And at this time, I'm honored to welcome another such dedicated individual, Elise Walter, the Honorable Commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission and a former colleague of Diane's.
Thank you so much. I'm told that the honorable, although technically yours forever, really only lasts while you're in the job, so watch out for me later. I'm delighted to be here with Diane's family and with the rest of you today at the Diane Sanger Memorial Lecture. Diane was one of my colleagues for many years and a dear and very loyal friend. Two of those years she worked for me, but I think it would be more accurate to say that I worked for her. Diane had rigorous standards and could be a tough critic. My own work often benefited from her insight, and I'd like to think that I occasionally may have lived up to her standards. During frustrating moments at the office, Diane's wit and her wicked sense of humor often salvaged my mood and my sanity. I thought of this side of Diane the other day as I was purchasing the latest piece of decor for my office, a 3-foot-wide sign that says, "I have flying monkeys and I'm not afraid to use them." Now, I must remind you that my remarks here this afternoon, including those about the utility of flying monkeys, represent my own views and not those of the commission, my fellow commissioners, the members of the staff, etc. And although I can't honestly say how my current colleagues may feel about flying monkeys, although the sign has received rave reviews in its 3 days in my office, I suspect that if she were here, Diane truly would have appreciated my new office ornamentation. On a more serious note, Diane was a zealous advocate for investors and one of the Commission's most dedicated public servants. This passion for investors was matched by another colleague of Diane's in the General Counsel's office, our speaker this afternoon, the Honorable, and he still deserves it, Harvey J. Goldschmidt. When Harvey joined the Commission as its General Counsel in 1998, he was already a distinguished scholar, not just in securities regulation, but also antitrust law, which happens to be the second language in my household, so I appreciate that, and corporate governance, another love of mine. Having served as a professor of law at Columbia and as a reporter for the American Law Institute's Principles on Corporate Governance Project for more than a decade. During his tenure as general counsel, Harvey helped draft Reg FD, which promotes fair disclosure to retail and institutional investors alike, and he also was an architect of the Commission's adoption of disclosure rules concerning audit committees of public companies. I could go on and on, but you want to hear from him. And I understand that the title of Harvey's lecture this afternoon is The Future of Investor Protection. He is particularly well-suited to speak about how we address the issues facing investors in light of the financial crisis and its aftermath. Harvey's service as a commissioner began when the commission was facing the corporate accounting scandals that plagued us all at the beginning of this century. He was critical to the effective implementation of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which brought important changes to the way issuers, auditors, and securities professionals conducted themselves, from CEO and CFO certifications to internal controls over financial reporting and reforms to the audit process. These measures have now become fundamental tools for promoting full and accurate disclosure to investors. As Shakespeare wisely said, "What's past is prologue," and these experiences undoubtedly give Harvey unique insight on the issues facing the Commission today in its mission to protect investors. This is not to say that Harvey's only insights into the future of investor protection come solely from his past service at the Commission. To the contrary, since leaving the Commission in 2005, Harvey remains an active and vital voice in our ongoing mission of investor protection, serving, among other things, as a public governor of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, as a trustee of the IFRS Foundation, and as a member of the governing board of the Center for Audit Quality, to mention just a few of his positions of leadership. But most important, he continues to instruct our next generation of public servants in the legal and securities industry as the Dwight Professor of Law at Columbia. And on a more personal note, Harvey has been an unfailing source of wisdom for me, particularly during my tenure both at FINRA and in my current position, where I serve as one of his successors. Please join me in welcoming the perfect choice to deliver a lecture named in Diane's honor and memory, the Honorable Harvey J. Goldschmidt.
It's always lovely to be introduced by an old friend who's kind and gentle and all that. I must admit that while I really do miss Washington in all kinds of ways, I don't miss the need to give a disclaimer at the beginning of every... Let me begin this lecture, and I'm delighted to be here, and I'm honored to be giving a lecture in Diane's name. Diane Sanger brought high intelligence, admirable dedication, rigorous standards, as Elise suggested, and a fundamental commitment to investor protection to all she did at the Commission. Diane's qualities of mind and character illustrated why the SEC, at its best, is an extraordinarily effective institution. In large measure, I associate the survival of the SEC, the survival of investor protection, rather, with the survival and health of the SEC. This afternoon, I'm going to discuss contemporary threats to the Commission and then consider threats to two key pieces of modern legislation, Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank. Given the limits of time, I may not get much Dodd-Frank, and to my surprise, it's important, for reasons we'll discuss, to talk about Sarbanes-Oxley. The threats to the SEC, let me focus on that first. The years since 2005 have not been easy for the Commission. There was a serious threat of elimination or dismemberment in the spring of 2009 as the Obama administration began its regulatory reform process. A commentary in Bloomberg and Elise, Close Your Ears, concluded as follows. At last, we're taking steps to tackle the crisis connected to subprime mortgages. But when are we going to get around to the fiasco of subprime regulators? Any chance Congress will get smart and dismantle the SEC? Through the heroic efforts of Mary Shapiro and Elise Walter and others, the SEC survived in the spring of 2009 and indeed gained considerable ground in Dodd-Frank, although, as I'll explain later, that's been something of a mixed blessing. But today I find myself growing increasingly concerned about the naivete and the stridency of the current attacks on the Commission. Commissioner Walter has spent 30 years understanding the Commission, its background, its philosophy. And she said the following recently. I didn't realize she was introducing me today, but I had this quote ready anyway. In the past 3.5 years, we have faced criticism that is unprecedented, and that's realistic. What's been happening? Basically, the Commission has been put under immense and unfortunate pressure by Congress and the federal courts. Congress has been starving the agency at a time when Dodd-Frank and court decisions have added enormously to its responsibilities. Now, I'm covering more today than anyone in his right mind should, but let me briefly reference the problems before the Commission. The SEC's budget for fiscal 2012 is about $1.3 billion. But the budget was frozen from 2005 through 2009, and the SEC had roughly 10%, lost 10% of its staff, and 50% of the budget for new IT projects. Today's budget, with all the catch-up needed in technology and personnel, is not adequate to meet the Commission's traditional needs. But Mary Shapiro has said, and I think quite accurately, the Commission needs 800 additional staff members and a doubling of its budget, which was contemplated in Dodd-Frank, in order to meet its new responsibilities. Responsibilities for derivatives, for hedge funds, for rating agencies, and on and on. At a budget vote 2 weeks ago, the House Financial Services Committee rejected a proposed $1.56 billion budget for the Commission for Fiscal 2013 and drew the following partisan, I'm not very partisan, but for me, accurate statement. According to you, Republican members, the SEC wasn't proficient, and according to us, because a Democratic member, they didn't have the resources to be proficient. But you don't make an agency more proficient by starving it. Now, that's not a profound point, but why can't it get its way over the Capitol Hill, which is not very far away? The Supreme Court, and this is part of the problem too, its hostility to private litigation has added large new pressures on the SEC. Stoneridge in 2008 and Janus in 2011 made private litigations under the 1934 Act against lawyers and investment bankers, no matter how intentionally fraudulent their activity, virtually impossible. Even accountants are largely off the hook. The SEC, with its aiding and abetting authority, now must fill a very large gap. Of course, the question again, where are the resources to do that? Remember that the SEC has traditionally said what the Supreme Court said in 2007 in the Telabs case, and I'm quoting, meritorious private actions to enforce federal anti-fraud securities laws are an essential supplement to the SEC. In a similar way, the Morrison case from the Supreme Court in 2010 took away from private action venal activity in the United States as long as the company was incorporated elsewhere or the closing was taking place there. Now, again, for the SEC, the power under traditional standards of significant conduct or substantial effect, they can reach that conduct. But the private cases cannot. Dodd-Frank added it back, but not for private cases, which means, again, a large gap to fill, a large new burden on the commission. In the lower federal courts, Jed Rakoff's Citigroup decision rejected and neither admits nor denies formulation for SEC settlements. Now, there's a surface plausibility to what Jed Rakoff, with no friend, did. In a sense, it's understandable that there'd be a distaste for X hundred million dollar settlements where defendant neither admits or denies any wrongdoing. Although the fact that defendant is paying X hundred million dollars and taking injunctive relief provides some hint that the defendant is making some kind of admission. But in the world we're in, the SEC settles well over 90% of its cases. The elimination of admit or deny, the requirement of an admission, would mandate huge new resources for litigation, for enforcement, and take enormously longer in terms of the realistic large case. Now, if Jed Rakoff had the power to double or triple the SEC's enforcement budget, everything would be fine. But in the real world, the Second Circuit last week indicated it was likely to reverse the Citigroup opinion, and that is the right answer. Another problem from the lower federal courts comes from the D.C. Circuit. It's demanding, impossibly demanding, cost-benefit analysis that was required in the proxy access case in Business Roundtable v. SEC in 2011. Now, I think it's offensive to anyone concerned about the proper role of Second Circuit courts to have its demanding, impossible set of burdens put on the Commission and other federal agencies as the cost-benefit standards do. The SEC's 60-page cost-benefit analysis in that case was sturdy, made sense. Now, I'm enough of an academic to know in this kind of classroom, I can pull apart anything. And cost-benefit is a legitimate approach. No one at the Commission makes decisions without thinking about cost and benefit to those concerned. But when the circuit court is going to be hyper-technical about how much is demanding and dotting I's and crossing T's that aren't even there, it in effect may be saying, we don't like the substance. And we haven't had that trouble in the federal courts since the 1930s, with substantive matters being overruled. Now, we could live with the D.C. Circuit's cost-benefit analysis if it had the power and was willing to substantially increase the budget of the SEC. But I haven't seen either the power or the willingness to do so. And again, this is putting enormous new burdens on the Commission and other parts of the federal government, too. The bottom line is a world in which the SEC had severe personnel shortages, severe technological shortages, and we've got to think about whether we're serious about that cop on the beat being effective in these times. Now, let me conclude on the following note. Historically, or at least this part of the talk, historically the SEC has stronger and weaker moments. I'd identify stronger moments in the early years with the chairmanships of Joseph Kennedy, of James Landis, and Bill Douglas. In the middle years, I'd identify strength with my colleague at Columbia, Bill Carey, and Manny Cohn. And with the bias I bring, I think, of the recent years of Arthur Levitt and Bill Donaldson, who I served with, at strong points for the Commission. Indeed, it was only 2004, the 70th anniversary of the Commission, that Paul Sarbanes and I, in ceremonies, talked about the Commission as the crown jewel of the federal system, and that was realistic then and ought to be now. Now, Mary Shapiro and Elise Walter and the others on the Commission have done a terrific job of revitalizing the agency and moving it forward. There have been bumps in the road, of course, but it is a stronger place than when they came. On the other hand, the years 2005 through 2009 were not the Commission at its best. The Madoff and Stanford scandals, although those occurred and began in earlier points, the Bear Stearns and Lehman failures, which resulted from lax and incompetent oversight, weak enforcement during that period. Bottom line of the period was indefensible passivity, at least for me. But the message has to be rebuild, reinvigorate, adequately resource, not marginalize or starve or dismantle. Otherwise, the survival of investor protection will be very much in doubt. Moving on to the legislation, I'd have thought that a serious debate about Sarbanes-Oxley near its 10th anniversary would be a non-starter. Sarbanes-Oxley has proven itself time and again. But Mitt Romney recently, this month in fact, earlier this month, called for repeal of Sarbanes-Oxley. And the current debate on Capitol Hill, the jobs bill, is before the Senate right now, I think, indicates that maybe I'd better take up the issue. I'm going to focus on the effectiveness on Sarbanes-Oxley in terms of the audit process and disclosure. Those were at the heart of Sarbanes-Oxley. But if I took up other areas, I'd come to the same conclusion. Sarbanes-Oxley has been a great success. Let me begin my discussion of Sarbanes-Oxley by bringing you back to the Enron and WorldCom scandals that became public in 2001 and 2002. As Elise Walter suggested, I took office at the SEC at a low moment. I was sworn in on July 31, 2002. U.S. financial markets were then in turmoil and the corporate community was in disrepute. July 31 was the day the president signed Sarbanes-Oxley. Into law. If helping to restore public confidence had been the only accomplishment of Sarbanes-Oxley, I'd praise what was done. The recent financial crisis, has again emphasized how critical trust and confidence are to our financial system. But far more than the atmosphere with change, Sarbanes-Oxley made dramatic long-term improvements to the nation's audit process and to public company disclosure. Let me take you through some of that. First, focusing on accountants and the accounting profession. I believe that directors, particularly independent directors, are the most significant actors in the U.S. corporate governance system. If all goes well, they provide the checks on senior managers that are critical. But the most important insight to be gained from the scandals of the 1990s and early 2000s, and again today from the recent financial crisis, is that even independent, demanding directors cannot carry the load alone. The U.S. corporate governance system is heavily dependent on proper disclosure and the effectiveness of various gatekeepers. Accountants are perhaps our most important gatekeepers in the United States. Two key issues face the Congress and the SEC in terms of Sarbanes-Oxley. How to strengthen the relationship between the independent accountants and the independent directors, and how to strengthen the accounting profession itself. On the question of how to strengthen the relationship between independent directors and independent auditors, the basic corporate governance idea was that independent, dispassionate directors would be able to take a balanced, long-term perspective in terms of what was going on. They would not feel the pressures on earnings management and other kinds of pressures that the full-time senior executives would feel. You were likely to be able to avoid improper earnings management and other overly aggressive or illegal disclosure practices if that relationship were strengthened. And realigning loyalties to strengthen the relationship between the audit committee and independent directors was the key to at least a lot of what was being done. Now, various steps were taken in Sarbanes-Oxley and by the SEC in terms of add-ons to it. They strengthened the definition of independence, there were whistleblowing provisions, provisions for experts to be hired, that kind of thing. The most important provision, interestingly enough, was a very simple one in concept. It said something like, the audit committee must take direct responsibility for the appointment, the evaluation, the compensation, and where appropriate, the firing of the independent auditor. Now, this has had a large effect. Recently, and I won't identify him, the CEO of a major public corporation said to me, neither the audit committee nor outside auditor understand. I'm the boss. Well, no more. That change has really been quite dramatic. Imperfect empirical evidence, my experience counseling audit committees, work by the Center for Audit Quality, and much anecdotal evidence suggests that Sarbanes-Oxley's audit committee provisions have made that large difference. Today, audit committees are spending more time, putting in far more effort, demanding far more from the outside auditor and corporate managements, and often seriously questioning what's going on. Now, the recent financial crisis demonstrates that it's not yet a perfect world. But what is critical to understand is that the evidence indicates that without Sarbanes-Oxley, things could have been much worse. Now let me turn to what Sarbanes-Oxley did to strengthen the accounting profession itself, and that largely involved the PCAOB. In a brief for the Supreme Court defending the constitutionality of the PCAOB, which I helped to draft for the Council of Institutional Investors and other institutional investors, we concluded as follows. The widespread failure by auditors to detect serious management fraud, which shocked American financial markets, occurred in large part because no one was watching the watches. The scandals demonstrated the inadequacy of accounting industry self-regulation. Now, inadequacy was about as mild a word as we could use. Self-regulation prior to Sarbanes-Oxley involved imperfect rulemaking, very little in the way of discipline and very little in the way of true inspections on terms of audit quality. The PCAOB has enormously enhanced all of those and put much of its budget into the inspections, the care, the driving the auditors to do a superior job, which I think is happening. Also, Sarbanes-Oxley got rid of a lot of the consulting that resulted in enormous pressure on the auditors and on the audit partner to give. That's all disappeared. Anyone who tells you that Sarbanes-Oxley hasn't had a profound, important, useful effect in the U.S. system is simply blind. Now, of course, the constitutionality of the PCAOB was largely upheld with relatively trivial modification. Let me turn to the most controversial part of what was happened in Sarbanes-Oxley, and that was Section 404, the internal control provisions, which are part of the focus on Capitol Hill today. The 404 provisions, to be blunt about it, are correctly described as the one, but I emphasize the word one, large dollar cost item in Sarbanes-Oxley. All of the other claims of excessive cost about Sarbanes-Oxley are largely fanciful. But in terms of 404, as the first chairman, Bill McDonough of the PCAOB, kept saying, how can you have a strong reporting and disclosure system or corporation without strong internal controls? Won't the cost be worth it? The answer for me is clearly yes. Now, 404 was implemented, and let me again be blunt, imperfectly. In terms of 404, and there's enough blame to go around, the SEC, the PCAOB, the accounting firms, and the public corporations all had missteps and wasted effort. But relatively quickly, in terms of the rulemaking process, the SEC and PCAOB made corrections along with the help of the profession. They took account of the need to do risk assessment, to use judgment, to rely on prior work. And today, 404 represents a cost-effective and wise public policy prescription. And yet, it's being challenged on Capitol Hill. For smallest companies, it's already gone. For companies up to quite large, towards $1 billion, it's now being challenged. Mary Shapiro concluded last week that the current version of the so-called jobs bill goes too far in diluting investor protection. More bluntly, Arthur Levitt called the legislation the most investor-unfriendly that I've seen in 25 years. Kept thinking of what legislation he was looking at. But investors, and I associate myself with both of their critiques, investor trust in the fairness and integrity of our financial markets, the willingness of 50% of our people to invest, gives the U.S. a great comparative advantage in the world. In terms of capital formation, in terms of jobs, this is what we must hold. It is extraordinarily unwise, in my view, to jeopardize the trust of the public with the kind of deeply flawed legislation that they've been debating on Capitol Hill this day. I'll move through, because I do want to leave time for questions, the disclosure provisions in Sarbanes-Oxley. But let me just emphasize the certifications, the better disclosure required, the more timely disclosure, all of those have worked. Our disclosure system is in much better shape than it once was. And there was a payback for that. In my last public meeting as a commissioner, we deregulated a lot of the 1933 Act, got rid of waste, foolish items, things that had just been there. There's nothing wrong with deregulation if you understand what you're doing and why. I think it's now been long enough, this was 2005, for me to be able to say that there was no investor protection harm from what was done through that deregulatory process. I hope and pray we're going to be able to say anything in the same line with the jobs bill on Capitol Hill. I'll take a minute, if it's all right, but only a minute, maybe two, on Dodd-Frank. Let me give you my overall evaluation of Dodd-Frank. It's put the United States in a much better place than we were before it was enacted, but it is certainly imperfect legislation. It could have been drafted to produce a stronger and more effective regulatory scheme and to avoid some of the uncertainty that has been created. But three basic points about Dodd-Frank. One, it's new legislation, obviously enacted in July 2010. An immense amount of new regulatory authority has been granted to federal agencies, but often with only limited congressional guidance. We are quite dependent on the agencies using their authority wisely. Most key implementing rulemakings are still works in progress. In one many basic ways, it's too early to really evaluate Dodd-Frank. But I suspect there will be bumps in the road in Dodd-Frank, much as 404 was a bump in the road for Sarbanes-Oxley. But in the end, if you go to a year like 2022, I suspect we will look back and think of Dodd-Frank's success. Second point, the Get Government Off My Back attacks on Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes-Oxley ignore the cost of Enron, WorldCom, and other turn of the 21st century scandals. Most importantly, they ignore the indefensible greed, intolerance of excessive risk and leveraging, and breakdowns in institutional responsibility, whether you think of mortgage banks, Wall Street broker-dealers, or credit rating agencies, in the private sector, which were the primary cause of the financial crisis. In terms of government regulation, there were clearly serious failures by the Federal Reserve, other bank regulators, and the SEC. But in general, the governmental failures involve sins of passivity and excessive trust in markets. This is what we must keep in mind when we think about legislation. Passivity, excessive trust, is what helped to bring the economy down. Final point, Sarbanes-Oxley significantly enhanced the enforcement powers of the SEC. Dodd-Frank greatly added to the SEC's regulatory responsibilities. Sarbanes-Oxley made available to the SEC new civil penalty powers, disgorgement powers, easier to obtain officer and director bars, broad remedial powers, and to the Department of Justice enhanced criminal sanctions, at least when things are willful. When the SEC is properly active, these enforcement powers help to create the essential deterrence and accountability the system needs. In our securities regulatory system, if it is to work, senior corporate executives, Wall Street types, various gatekeepers must know they are likely to be held accountable when wrongdoing occurs. Effective deterrence requires a strong and credible threat. It is that threat that creates powerful incentives to avoid wrongful acts and bring about cultural, procedural, and process changes necessary to protect investors. Sarbanes-Oxley enhanced accountability and deterrence. Dodd-Frank has that potential, but the current political atmosphere and deadlocks on Capitol Hill leave me concerned about the future. As with much of Dodd-Frank, it is too early to be certain where we were heading. Basically, the issue today is whether we will have the will and wisdom to maintain the strength of investor protection, or whether deregulatory slogans and ignorance will cause us to lose our way. For me, long-term investor trust and confidence are the keys to making our financial system work. Here, with the sponsorship of the SEC Historical Society, it would be nice if those in power in this great city could learn the lessons of the past. Thank you very much. The
Professor Goldschmidt has indicated he will take questions from people here in the audience at Georgetown. So if you have a question, please step to the microphone in the center and speak up so that people here as well as online can hear you. Thank you.
Here comes someone. Looks like a student. I'm worried.
My name is Charles Lee. I'm an LLM candidate at the Law Center, and I was wondering if you could share with us what aspects of the House's version of the Jobs Act do you think are good ideas in that they further capital formation without hurting investor protection?
Well, there are a number of things in there that seem to make some sense. The ones I'm most troubled with are the accounting disclosure provisions, but there were, for instance, provisions, and a lot of things stuck in there. It's provision that says FASB's rules may not apply. There's another provision that kind of, you know, would give you the five-year period again. It's much too long. I could live, I think, with a $2 or $3 million situation. And some of the crowding, the aspects of the bill, may be okay, but again, the figures are way too high. It's one thing to take away some of the protections for a $200 million company. When you get up to $7, $8, $9 billion, it's just unwise. And so it's not all of the provisions that are unwise, but there's an awful lot in there that's either bad or ambiguous. Good luck on Capitol Hill.
I want to take you back to what you were talking about with respect to the auditing standards that underlay 404B. And you described the first step as a misstep that got corrected a few years later with auditing standard number 5. Obviously, a lot of damage was done by the misstep politically and setting in motion a campaign in corporate America to get rid of this. Why did the misstep occur?
Oh, it's hard. It's hard to explain. Well, let me give you a little history. I sat with the accounting profession at one point and said, are you ready to go? Do you understand the COSO standards well enough and the guidance well enough? And the answer was always yes, and then we gave them more time. There were accountants who were asked to do internal controls who didn't have a clue. We had people coming in, and that's when I realized that we had a serious problem, from the corporate community saying, the accountants came in, and they went to the warehouse. I mean, this is literally a quote just about. And they had 5 cameras in the warehouse, and they said, we need a 6th. And I said, internal controls for financial things? And they, for some reason, they thought they could cover things. That type made no sense at all. The SEC drafting was imperfect, although Alan Beller, who did a lot of the drafting, as you know, was first rate. But it wasn't clear enough that you could take account of risk, you could use judgment, you could rely on prior work done. And that was made clear in a revision, PCAOB revision, within 2 years. There's no doubt there were mistakes. I mean, life is like that. But did we correct them? Yeah. Did we correct them relatively quickly? Yes. And did it hurt the SEC and did it hurt 404? Without any doubt. But what you're carrying over today is a kind of ancient history that's come into myth. This is very, it's not expensive anymore, not at the same level. And the payback is much greater. It's preventing people from becoming public. Not true. By the way, we ought to keep in mind, not every company ought to be public or ought to have the money of real investors who are going to take a beating. As the population grows older, particularly, we have too many people who are not going to understand that this new ramp they're creating, and then you can make a case for a ramp, and Don, you've done that, but not the ramp they've created. And you don't want those people suddenly saying, And families for years after that saying, we will not invest. We cannot trust this. If you care about jobs, losing that willingness to invest in the long term is destructive beyond anything that I can tell you.
Hi, Matt Bizanza, JD candidate. Touching on your earlier comment about the self-regulatory aspect of the accounting profession, I was interested in your comments on some of the proposals to deal with self-regulation of the broker-dealers through something like FINRA and the sort of effectiveness of a FINRA-type entity to dealing with that new issue of Dodd-Frank.
FINRA is quite different. I mean, if you take patterns, the old AICPA system for self-regulation of the accounting industry was an in-house operation. And they did bring an outsider on. They brought me on and Joel Seligman in terms of the disciplinary process. But that process was set up in such a way that even a very decent group of accountants on the oversight committee couldn't ever bring a case. There were 3,000 reasons why any accountant could say this ought to be deferred. No one was prosecuted in a serious way under that system, or at least almost none. Rulemakings, again, were not neutral. They were done with a kind of protective instinct in terms of accountants. And again, the peer reviews that went on were imperfect is the mildest word. Don't take it as a serious word. They were worse than that. The other side of that is the PCAOB, appointed by the commission with a budget that gets approved by the commission, and a very different kind of budget than what's being used in the self-regulatory scheme. I think that's worked very well. Now, FINRA, I bring a certain bias to, as Elise indicated. I've been on the board of governors of FINRA for some years now. It's a very decent group. It does a good job. The question is, how much do you gain? The board is made up, I guess there are 22. I think there's a majority of one in terms of independent directors, or non-industry directors. But many of the non-industry directors also have some industry background. I think it works fairly well. It's a balancing. The advantage is you do get industry input. You do get serious kind of concerns about things. There is an emphasis on efficiency that might otherwise be lost in terms of how the broker-dealer world works. On the other hand, there is an industry input. For my time, satisfied it works to some real degree. Indeed, I take with at least the view that when it comes to investment advisors, where we have almost no oversight or inspection or anything else, it would be much better to have FINRA doing it or some group like FINRA. One way to, again, understand this budget crunch resource problem in the United States is the SEC budget now is about $1.3 billion, as I said. That covers everything. Public companies, investment firms, advisors, broker-dealers, the entire waterfront, including all of the enforcement activities. It's really, again, inadequate. It's much too mild a word. FINRA's budget is between $800 and $900 million, focused solely on broker-dealers. That allows for serious inspections and other things. Without that kind of resource, we'd be in trouble. Now, one can argue in an ideal world that all ought to be governmental, but where are you going to get Congress to give you an extra $900 million? And if they gave it to you, I'm not sure you'd want to spend it just that way. There are all kinds of other priorities that have to be looked at. So AICPA model, put an X next to it. It just doesn't work. FINRA, yes, with a balancing. PCAOB, I think, has been a remarkably effective operation in general. Again, with ins and outs, but generally, it's certainly right now, it seems to be running very well. They want to get to the drinks.
Professor, thank you from all of us here, as well as our audience online, for sharing your wisdom and your experience. For the benefit of those who are unable to attend, today's lecture is now permanently preserved in the Society's virtual museum and archive at the aforementioned www.sechistorical.org. We hope that today's program recognizes all those currently working in the regulation of financial markets, and that Diane Sanger's life serves as an inspiration for those considering such a career in the future. Good afternoon.